This is a No Dogma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Jay Gambetta, Manager for Quantum Theory and Computing at IBM, based in New York. Thank you for taking the time this evening, Jay.
No problem. Hey, hello.
Can you tell me a little bit about your background first, Jay?
Yeah, so I grew up in Australia, in Brisbane. I've been doing quantum computing research since 2000, and I've gone pretty much from Australia over to the US, a little bit of time in Canada, and now I'm doing quantum information research at IBM.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what you do at IBM?
Yeah, so at IBM, we're trying to work towards working out how to put qubits together and realize we're working towards realizing the building blocks for building the next generation of computers, and these are like quantum computers.
If you could briefly, as much as possible, give us a flavor for what quantum computing is and why it's significantly different than traditional computing.
Yeah, this one's always hard to do. So a lot of people think quantum is it's faster, like it's the next step in Moore's law, and this is not true. You got to think of it as it's fundamentally different. So what it does is it computes using the laws of nature, the quantum mechanical laws, that allow you to do the computation in a completely different way. It uses entanglement and interference, and it does them to do things that you cannot do classically. I tried to say to people, stay away from making an analogy in the classical world, because there's just nothing you'll experience that is the same as in the quantum. And there are two principles that basically define quantum, and these are a system that comprises of two parts is more complicated than its parts, so it can have more correlations than its part, and this is what we refer to as entanglement. And the second is that even if I completely give my system and say I know everything about it, it can still behave randomly in some circumstances, and you'll never experience this classically.
So a funny thing, I have another podcast on quantum, and there's a lot more information, and we're not going to go into it here, but it was with an American who's working in Australia, and now this podcast is with an Australian who's working in America. We'll kind of skip past the nitty-gritty of quantum a little bit, but just how do quantum computers look these days?
Yeah, so they look much different to classical computers. Our systems are superconducting qubits. We have to get them down to a few millikelvin, and this is much, much colder than outer space. So they exist inside a big set of cryogenic refrigerators, and so you see a lot of tubes they use to keep a lot of wires going in that are our signals, and then there's a lot of overhead to cool this thing down. So They look much like the original computers, lots of cables and things going everywhere, but a lot of that is really advanced technology to make sure that we can precisely control these systems and cool them down to temperatures where the quantum effects dominate.
Just a slight aside, I remember maybe 20, 25 years ago, getting down close to absolute zero was less common and much harder. Has it become an easier thing to do now?
Yes, the cryogenic technology has improved quite a lot. It is, there are push buttons that allow you to cool these devices down. There's still a lot of work that goes into making sure you have the right attenuation and thermalization inside. But part of the reason the success is all this increased technology that exists.
All right, we're going to move away a little bit from the nitty gritty of quantum and more towards what IBM is doing and the quantum experience. But maybe before we get to that, can you just talk a little bit about IBM's interest in quantum computing?
Yeah, so IBM is interested in this. We've been interested in it for a very long time. Some of the original proposals from quantum information science originated in quantum in IBM, where Charlie Bennett with Ralph Landau were asking questions about the fundamental relationship between physics and information. And this led to them thinking about how much they were asking the question of, can you do computation without producing energy? And this led them to really understanding and asking fundamental questions in quantum information, which then with many others around the world, we've come to the conclusion that if we can build a quantum computer, there now exist algorithms which we have no idea how to do them efficiently classically, and we can use these quantum properties of entanglement to allow us to find a solution to these problems in a faster time, where it's not that the gates are getting done faster, it's just doing it in a completely different way, that the cost of doing the algorithms is much smaller.
How long would you say IBM has been in the quantum world?
Yeah, so Charlie Bennett, I think on our website, we have a clipping from some of his notes that go back to the early 70s, where he uses late 70s, where he uses the term quantum information while he was working some stuff out. And yeah, so it's about 35 years, maybe a bit more.
So now we're going to get on to kind of the main topic for the podcast, and it's IBM's quantum experience. So can you start telling us about that, please?
Yeah, so what is the quantum experience? So what we did is we put online some of our technology to allow anyone in the world to come in and program a quantum computer. So they can go in, and we call it a score, and the score represents, like much like a musical score, a series of bars, lines versus time, where they can place different gates. And these gates, then they can design some type of quantum circuit, and by designing this quantum circuit, they can then submit it through the cloud, it gets uploaded to our hardware, and then the results are sent down inside this fridge, then the results come back, and then analyzed by the user online. So it's really a cloud-based quantum computer where you can experiment and explore some of these different concepts of quantum computing.
But what the user ends up hitting is this computer with wires down to the millikelvins in the end. Is that correct?
Yes. So it goes. So if you want to think about, like, if we were to go through the whole process, the user would first come and design, pick how many qubits, say they were using the 5-qubit one that we put on. They would choose those 5 qubits. They would design the quantum circuit that they would want to run, which will consist of single and 2-qubit gates. And they would design this first time. They'd place which qubits they would want to be measured. And so they would design a circuit, and we have a representation of this that we call OpenQuasim, that just, you can think of this as like machine code that represents that circuit they design. That circuit then would be submitted through the cloud, and then that goes actually to, first of all, it goes to another computer, and those gates they designed are turned into microwave pulses. So each one of them has a different microwave frequency, shape, and it's like you're going from some digital form to some analog microwave pulses. Those microwave pulses are generated and then sent down all this equipment that we describe to the devices, which are right down the bottom. And those microwave pulses cause the qubits to rotate and respond in different ways. And then at the end, another pulse comes down to interrogate the state of the qubit, and that's the measurement. And what you get back is a response that you that comes back out of it, and then you make a decision on that response, whether the qubit was in a zero state or a one state, and then that's given back to the user.
Who can use this?
At the moment, the 5 we've made available for anyone. You just have to sign up for an account, and anyone from a tech enthusiast to a PhD student or someone that just wants to learn about quantum computing can come in there and use the 5. The 16 that we just put out is still under beta access. So you, through the same website, you can request to use that, but we're still, just because there's a lot more qubits, going through a process of only accepting a few people over time.
And when a person, let's say the 5-qubit one, because it's more available, when a person writes the, I'm just going to call it the program, is it something that they have to learn a new language for, or is it a little easier than that?
Yes, they got it. You got to completely. So, the first part that you give, I like to call it a circuit. It feels a bit weird because people think of a circuit as some electrical circuit, but in quantum information scientists, we call a quantum circuit a bunch of gates that represents something that we want to run. So they have to learn what these primitives mean. So some of these primitives are familiar, like one of them could be a bit flip, and we denote that with an X, which means a zero goes to a one. But then there are other gates, which we call a Hadamard, which takes a zero from a zero to a zero to zero plus one. So it makes a superposition of a single qubit. These gates don't exist classically, so you have to sort of learn what they are. And then there are other variants, other various single qubit gates that you can do that do different types of superpositions with different types of phases. And then finally, there's two qubit gates like a controlled knot. And what this will do is it'll flip the target qubit depending on the state of the control qubit. So you have to sort of get an appreciation for a much different set of gates than you would have had if you were learning digital digital computing on binary back at university or something like that. So you've got to learn a different set of commands that are going to be sent. So you've got to experience with it, but we've tried to define them and give the user the ability to learn what these do.
What can a person do, let's say, with the 5 qubits and then with the 16 that... What would be a couple of examples of things you might do?
So with the thing online and working through the web interface, you can only run one quantum circuit. So with only running a single quantum circuit, you basically start the qubits in some state and then run your gates and measure. So there's not enough flexibility to really look at programs, and I'll talk a bit about how we give you the ability to start doing programs. But with that you can still start to learn a bit about quantum. So with 5, the main purpose is education and just starting to build up this ecosystem, because there really isn't this like source of experts or there's a lot of people that have a lot of education like myself in quantum information science, but there's not a lot of developers or people that have familiarity with this. So the main thing is to really get that education going in with the 5. With the 16, you can start to really look at and ask interesting questions about the system itself. You can start to say, like, one of the hardest questions that we have in science for doing quantum computing is answering the questions, how do we prove that the system is a quantum computer? Because it's actually very hard. You've probably heard people say that quantum computers have access to this exponential space. So if you had to measure every possibility of this state with 16 qubits, that starts to get a large number, and it gets actually hard to work out exactly what it's doing. So the question of proving that it is truly quantum is a difficult task, especially when this number gets around 50 or 100 qubits. So you can start to come up with ways of understanding the noise and measuring the noise or measuring the properties of the system and see if you've got more advanced techniques that didn't exist before. And so you can really do research on this number.
With the 16 qubits, could you give an example maybe of some mathematical problem I could address with 16 that's better than doing it with 5 or whatever it might be?
Yeah, this is a question we get asked a lot. And the truth is 16 is still too small of a number that you can really come up with something useful to run on it, because I can still simulate on my laptop 16 qubits. So you can't really look at problems of practical interest yet. You're still in the phase of really understanding how this problem, how a quantum computer works, and how you can actually do tasks of understanding the errors. This being said, by getting up to 16, you can start to ask questions of, when I do these certain set of operations, how is the answer to the simple task scaling with the number of qubits, and start to get a feel for what you would predict when we get to this point, that is beyond what we can simulate with a conventional computer.
Something that makes it into the media occasionally is the idea that quantum computers, when they reach a certain scale, will be able to defeat all encryption, and that's the end of your SSL and your SSH. How many qubits would you say, roughly? Are you talking hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands to do something like that?
Yeah, this is another really good question, and maybe it's good to point a few things out here.
Sure.
Yeah, so a lot of confusion happens when people confuse logical qubits for physical qubits. And so we know that with logical qubits, and these are essentially a qubit that is has some type of fault-tolerant encoding, so it's not experiencing errors, we can do things like Shor's algorithm. And Shor's algorithm is the algorithm that's behind those statements. And with a couple of hundred to a thousand logical qubits, you can definitely start to break some of the encryption that exists out there. However, logical qubits to physical qubits is an active research area. And coming up and understanding how you actually do fault-tolerant quantum computing, where you use a minimum number of extra qubits, it's a hard question. And that's actually probably going to be one of the first applications of these small systems that we put out, is coming up with the best codes to encode those qubits into a logical qubit. And so to answer your question where you said, how many do you need? It's really hard to answer because the number depends very strongly on how much error correction you need. And if we don't make significant improvements in our gate errors and things like that, this number could be up to the hundreds of thousands or maybe even a billion. But it's my belief, with having real hardware and learning how errors emerge in that real hardware and designing codes for our hardware and keep pushing our understanding of how to do fault-tolerant error correction and things like that better, this number may come down. But fault-tolerant quantum computing is still a long way away. And so what seems to be emerging at the moment is a sort of near-term field that I like to call approximate quantum computing. And that's where we ask, what can we do with these near-term devices of the order of 50 to 100? And that, as I said, one of the most definite important things to do is to demonstrate like small codes and fault tolerance and just basically how we better control the qubits. Other things is to try and actually come up with ways of understanding in these smaller systems whether we have some type of quantum advantage over if we were to run this classically. And this question is hard to get at, but there are a lot of people working at trying to come up with something along those lines. And the other ways is, just as I said before, is verifying the system is truly behaving quantum, or looking at heuristic algorithms for chemistry or optimization type problems. But it's hard to prove anything in this space, but we can run things and see how they perform. So I think more importantly, the answer to your question is the first applications of quantum computing probably aren't going to be breaking encryption. They're going to be working out how we put systems together and make them behave bigger, and how we try and exploit the advantage that we have with these near-term qubits that are not like fault-tolerant, which means protected against errors that might occur anywhere in the computation, but are working pretty good.
How much has the public 5 one been used?
Yeah, so I forget the exact number off the top of my head, but I think there's about 19 or so papers that have been published on the archive where people have run experiments using it. They've looked at everything from testing our system up against different systems to different types of visualization to trying to ask questions about quantum information and things like this, but really just a lot of researchers getting there and testing their ideas on real hardware. And there's been many hundreds of thousands of experiments that have been run by lots of people that have used it. So it's had a lot of access. I was actually, one of the things I was pleasantly surprised that people were using it and actually writing their results up and publishing them on the, posting them to the archive and eventually publishing them.
When you're saying hundreds of thousands of people used it, I've seen things in the past, not quite like this, but you might submit a job and you might have to wait 10 hours or 2 weeks or something like that for it to be run. What's the case with the 5 and the 16? When I've written my circuit, how long will it take for you to send it off, do all the things you mentioned, and get me back a response?
Yeah, so there's a queuing system that we've put in place, but generally quantum experiments at the moment don't take that long to run. They're over in less than a second because the coherence times of our devices are of the order of 50 microseconds to 100 microseconds. So if you run much longer in the quantum time than that, you're just going to get noise. But there's processing loading time, which puts it up into the milliseconds. But within like 20 to 60 seconds, depending on the queue, you'll get your results back.
Oh, that quick. Okay, so you're just... how long would it take an average person to write their circuit or to submit it?
Yeah, so if you're going to use the online web tool, you've got to write it by dragging and dropping, and that we've now put a little tech thing in it, a text editor in it. That takes a while to sort of write out. What we've been working towards and putting in place is more of a SDK where users can use a programming language like Python, and then they can automate a lot of this process. And then they can submit many different circuits that are only a little bit different and submit it as a batch. And so that gives the user a lot more flexibility and a lot faster to do it than going onto a tool and like entering gate by gate into the quantum score.
And was that something that you decided to do based on the usage by people, or was it just the direction you were moving anyway, to move towards Python and an API and SDK?
It was definitely a direction we wanted to go, because when we do research, we don't just run a single circuit. So if I wanted to, say I wanted to do a technique that we do for verifying how our qubits are performing, we run many different random circuits and then look at the collective decay. And so you want to give the user the ability to submit a batch of different circuits and then look at all the results and combine them together in some way. So we knew that we had to give this type of flexibility. It's more natural from my view to build this into a language that already has a lot of flexibility for generating things. So our first choice was Python, just because it's a very flexible language to work with. So I think the natural evolution after giving people the first sort of taste for what, like, they like, I think of the web tool, like where you can use the website, it's being able to log in and do what you see in a textbook. Like, you might see your first circuit in a textbook, and you can pick up and you can say, all right, these are the gates, we run it, we make a Bell state, we see that it's entangled. Well, actually, we make a Bell state. And if you want to actually see if it's entangled, you actually have to ask different questions to that same state that you made. So you have to measure it in different bases. And then you have to add all those results together. So we had to get to the point where the user was able to build a lot of circuits so they could submit all these circuits, combine them together with different methods that we supply depending on the problem to get the data that they want.
Is there a hello world in the 5-qubit space or in the quantum experience?
Yeah, that's a good question. What would be the quantum computing hello world? Maybe it's either probably in my view, make your first Bell state. So show that you take 2 qubits, and you do a series of gates that you show that the outputs give you 0, 0 or 1, 1. They're correlated. Or it's make a superposition of take a qubit and make a superposition. These are definitely some of the first things that you would run as a as your first example of trying something on a quantum computer.
And that's relatively straightforward to do in Python now?
Yeah, so you could do that already on the online experience, but you definitely, you can, we give a tutorial where in the Python Git hub that we have that shows you how to do these two experiments as well.
So I've done a little bit of Python, and what I've seen is when you're trying to do something that's not part of the standard language, I think, is it just an import and then you call the various commands. So is it as simple as including or importing the IBM SDK and then doing your conditionals or your loops or your whatevers and submitting it? Or do you have to write your Python in a different way for it to work?
Yeah, well, I like to think it's as simple as just importing the things we've put into place. You import the IBM's SDK, and then we made a program object, a quantum program object, and then you just add to that quantum program object the circuits you want to run. So we kind of view it as three different phases in the quantum project. The first is the building. You add the different circuits, load them up, or manipulate them in some way. The next is the sort of compile. So then you say, I want to run it locally or I want to run it online. If you want to get something fast and just sort of see, you can, and it's small enough, you can simulate it. And even 16, you could still simulate. You can run it locally to simulate what an ideal one would do. So you can compile it either to the different backends, and then we execute it. And once you execute it, we have commands to get the results. So it's kind of like a build, execute, and sort of visualize stage to it. But it's all doing standard Python commands.
As part of that compile, is the compiler aware of the limitations with 5 qubits or 16 qubits that if you're building something, I don't know, if you're trying to break encryption, for example, and submit it to your system, will you be rejected long before you submit it or at some point along the way?
The compiler is not that smart yet. Think of this as really at the start of computing. Like, you are doing the compile section at the moment is more see what the backend has, understand what gates that backend supports, map your circuit to that by inserting swaps and things like that, and run it. We're really at the early stages, and you're just manipulating. I like to think of it more like an intermediate representation or some type of machine code that's going to be sent to the quantum computer. So it's a very low level compiler. So at the moment, it's only just checking that it can run on that and working out how to run it on that. One of the things I hope to do with the community and that is how do we develop those better compilers? How do we get smarter compilers? Compiling in quantum is difficult because if I get over a number of qubits that I can't simulate, I can't predict what it's going to do. So I've got to engineer smart ways of compiling. And there's been a lot of work in the field, but giving people the flexibility to design and try different types of compilers is one of the things that we would like to see.
How much involvement are you getting from the community with regard to, you know, feedback on compilers, feedback on language features, pull requests and the like?
Yeah, so we just started, so there's not that much yet. There's a couple of features that people are adding. We are trying to get it much more easier for people to use and load, and I'm hoping this will increase. At the moment, a few people have added just visualization tools and things like that. So it's in the early days. I think a lot of people are interested, but at the moment, it's still got a lot of way to go before we really see a lot of community activity.
Where do you see quantum computers taking us maybe in the next 5 years and then maybe 10 or 15 years?
Where they're going to go is most likely in this sort of trying to do something without full universal fault tolerance, so doing something in this approximate quantum computing range. We've tried to define a metric for defining how to measure the progress of the hardware, and we call it the quantum volume. And so this is related to the errors per the qubits, the connectivity of the system, and how many qubits you have. So I think over the next few years, we're going to see us pushing the ability for us to run longer and bigger systems and explore more of this, more of the quantum Hilbert space. And at some point, you'll cross the point where there'll be not just one, but many demonstrations of quantum being better at classical at some tasks. So I think over the next 5 years, we're definitely going to look back and say, quantum, this is when quantum computing really came, went from like being something that was done in the labs of universities and more for research to it becoming a technology.
On that, what you were talking about, though, was that supercooling. Do you see any prospect of not needing that millikelvin from absolute zero being a requirement?
For superconducting qubits, you need to keep them cold because the frequency of them is in the gigahertz. And so if they're not cold enough, there's just too much background radiation around. So it's going to stay, for these type of hardware, it's definitely going to stay requiring all this architecture to keep them cold. But I really don't see this as a problem because quantum computers are not going to be like replacing everything. Not all algorithms are sped up by a quantum computer. So it's not going to become like your mobile phone or something like that. It's really going to become kind of like a GPU is. It's a specially built thing to do certain problems better. I like the analogy to a GPU, but I also don't like it because a GPU is, it does the same thing but faster, whereas a quantum does it in completely a new way but may speed up something that is, may speed up, it does it in completely new way that has the potential of doing that task with much less steps, so you get this effective speed up. So it's always going to be something that you're going to want to call into to do some part of your problem. And you're really going to have in these sort of next generation, in the next 5 years, this sort of understanding this hybridization between doing some of your computation on the classical computer and the quantum. We really like these variational quantum eigensolver algorithms. And so what they exist in is we have the quantum computer evaluate something that depends on the size of the quantum state, some cost function. And then we use the variational, a classical computer, to choose the quantum parameters that go, the parameters that go into generating different quantum states. And we then just minimize a problem. And I see us looking at lots of things, as I mentioned before, in say understanding material science or looking at chemistry and things like that.
Any final notes before we wrap up for tonight, Jay?
So final notes is this time is definitely going to be exciting. It's going to be chaotic. I like to say it's going to be very, I think it's going to be very similar to the early days of digital quantum computing. And I, for everyone out there that wants to learn and understand quantum, I would advise staying away from trying to make analogies to things you experience in the everyday world. Quantum randomness and entanglement is definitely different to anything you would come across in your everyday experiences. So I'd suggest going to our quantum experience, logging in, and trying some circuits and seeing what they do and get a different intuition for how information is processed in the quantum world.
What's the easiest way to find information about the quantum experience or get started?
Yeah, you can just Google the IBM Quantum Experience, or you can go to the website www.research.ibm.com/IBM-Q/.
Sounds good. I'll put links into the podcast notes. Well, Jake and Beta, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thank you.
The opening music was Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Touching Light by Scott Holmes from the album Music for Media Volume 2.